us with this respect for the powerful. If you have to choose between the god of the slave owner and the god of the enslaved, naturally you will choose the former. All history teaches us that lesson.
It does not teach me that lesson, sir, for one, Delblanc said, rather carelessly, but with no trace of a smile. Christ spoke to the wretched and powerless as one of them, did he not? I have always understood that the Christian religion was spread among slaves. The Reverend Calabanda leaned forward, and Paris saw his nostrils distend slightly.
A few ragged trouser fellows talking in cellars, he said with contempt. It was the Roman rulers who spread the faith. Governors of provinces like this, our governor here, officers of garrisons like our good major, the treasurers and keepers of...
Excuse me, please. One of the Scandinavians had come to sudden and unexpected life. He laid down knife and fork and looked with large, vague eyes at the eloquent chaplain. A new word we have now, and a new mission. Our mission now is to learn from Africa. His colleague nodded. Your efforts, excuse me, they are going in a wrong direction. It is from Africa to Europe that the spirit is flowing, and we must open ourselves to receive it. The Church of the West is corrupted. God has declared a last judgment on it. Now is the time of the fourth church. We are forerunners. We go in advance to found his celestial city.
Open ourselves to receive it?
A broad smile had overspread Calabanda's face.
The celestial city, he said, out there in the bush? Excuse me if I laugh. Have I been ordained into the Anglican rite and subscribed, after much self-questioning, to the 39 articles, only to come back here and open myself to receive the spirit flowing from people living in mud huts and talking in obscure languages?
With the mildness of the utterly convinced, the first of the two missionaries began again to speak of God's plans for Africa. God had promised that the New Jerusalem would be founded among the heathen, and the Africans of the interior had been chosen because they, among the heathen peoples, were the most spiritual. Under cover of this, Delblanc leaned forward and said in low tones to Paris, "I don't know which is the madder, do you? What are you doing in this bedlam, may I ask?"
I believe it was mentioned to you that I am the ship's surgeon.
Paris spoke rather coldly. It was clear to him that Delblanc was a man of birth and education, but his own provincial and rather narrow upbringing had accustomed him to more circumspect modes of address, and the lack of ceremony jarred a little on him. His pride suspected there might be some disparagement in it. But the expression of the other's face was humorous and friendly, and his brown eyes were alert with the interest of his question.
"Well, of course I know that,"
Delblanc said with a hint of impatience. He was quick and open in all expression of feeling, as Paris was to learn.
"That doesn't explain anything. You do not seem to me to be typical. That is why I asked."
Something extremely youthful, innocent almost, in the confidence of this pronouncement, amused Paris suddenly and took the stiffness out of him. Delblanc, who, like many enthusiastic persons, often amused without intending to, saw the long, patient face opposite him break into a smile of singular sweetness.
"I have not had time to become typical," the surgeon said. "I suppose it takes time, doesn't it? This is my first voyage."
"Ah, that is it, then." The note of disappointment in this, as at some promising line of inquiry frustrated, made Paris smile again.
"What are you doing here, for that matter?"
he asked, borrowing the other's directness. "I believe you are an artist."
"I do not know if I would so dignify it," Delblanc said. "I can paint a good likeness, or so I thought."
A shadow had come to his face. He appeared to reflect a moment or two, then said, half to himself,
"It occurs to me, I wonder if your captain would agree to take me as a passenger."
Before Paris had time to answer this, the governor had risen to his feet, a signal for everyone else at the table to do the same, and remain so until he had left the room. The major, by this time relying heavily on the back of his chair for support, and the treasurer, who had said nothing during the meal, also visibly befuddled.
"Mr. Paris," Delblanc said quickly, "I know we have not been long acquainted, but there is a matter I would dearly like your advice on. I suppose you are staying here tonight? I would be most grateful. I have some rather good brandy in my room."
Paris hesitated briefly. He had been looking forward to the solitude of his own quarters, but there had been a quality of appeal in Delblanc's tone, as there was in the clear, ingenuous eyes that now regarded him.
"Very well," he said, "but I'd better make sure first that Captain Thurzo has no further need of me."
Thurzo, who had requested half an hour with the governor after dinner, was ready enough to confirm this. He did so, in fact, with discourteous emphasis. Paris's presence was increasingly an irritant to him these days. Nevertheless, it was in a spirit of resentment rather than relief that he watched his surgeon's retreat, the broad-shouldered, awkward form, the tendency to step a little short, as if about to alter pace or make some bounding advance, which in fact was never made. The man had been no earthly use from the start, merely a source of trouble and vexation. He was conducted into a small chamber on an upper floor, which the governor used as an office. Here he was offered brandy, while the governor himself, now in pale blue robe and round black skullcap, sipped at a glass of pale fluid.
"Chamomile tea, sir," he said with customary languidness. "An excellent specific for the digestion. I take a glass of it lukewarm every evening before retiring for the night. Lukewarm, not too hot, in case you ever feel tempted to try it."
A small fire was burning in the grate, though the evening was not cold. He had one lit, he explained, in all the apartments he used,
"to combat the infernal damp that is constantly emanating from the stone," he said. "Well, sir, how may I be of service to you? I understand from Saunders that you saw the slaves, but expressed some reservations."
"Reservations."
The word came gravelled with effort, as if only outrage could have forced it from the reluctant larynx.
"Sir, I cannot buy the slaves at the prices you are asking. There is no profit for my owner at those prices."
"Come now, Captain." The governor spoke with the same nonchalance, but his gaze had sharpened. "You know well that there is still profit in it for you. If we were dealing privately together, no doubt I could offer you a lower price, but you must remember the heavy expenses the company is under in the maintenance of this fort. There is a small army here of clerks, factors, artificers, who all have to have their wages. There is a chaplain. There are the permanent officers of the company. There is a garrison of 100 troops at the company's charge for victuals. Allow me also to remind you that you enjoy all the advantages of warehousing here without a penny of cost. The company acts as a depot for the goods. They are collected here and wait for you, saving you the trouble and danger of foraging in the unhealthy swamps behind. Moreover, the company takes care of relations with local chiefs and all intermediaries in the trade, and lays out money to keep them well disposed. But I don't really need to remind you of this, do I, Captain? You're an old hand."
"Yes, sir, I am. Of course I know the company has expenses, but so they did in the days of your predecessor, and he kept the surcharge to 5 bars a head. I know these up-country prices. I would be surprised if you were paying more than 20 bars. Your predecessor..."
"My predecessor died here." The governor's face was still set in its usual expression of cold composure, but his voice had risen. "He lies out there in the graveyard on the hill, with his name cut rough in the stone by a drunken mason. He lasted 18 months before drink and the climate finished him. It is not my way to explain myself, Captain Thurzo, but tonight is perhaps something of an occasion. It is a year to the day since I came out here." The governor paused for some moments with head raised.
"That knocking still," he said. "They're working through the night."
"They will have light enough for it," Thurzo said stolidly. "It is a full moon tonight."
The governor compressed his lips. There was so little colour in them that only the moulding of the corners indicated the contours of the mouth. Again, in what was clearly a habitual gesture, he dabbed at his face with his handkerchief.
"A year to the day," he said. "And apart from some loss of colour and occasional qualms and fluxes, I am as well as ever I was. Sir, I spent everything I had to purchase this post as director of the company.
The competition for such positions nowadays is fierce, as I dare say you know. I spent many months soliciting interest on my behalf in London. I had to go to the Jews for the balance of the money and agree to pay the interest they asked. I have to recover what I've laid out and make my profit while there is time, sir. This climate eats Europeans. War with France could come any day now, with French privateers lying off these coasts, disrupting our trade. You take my meaning. It is a question of time, Captain.
Well, sir, Thurso said, it is a question of time for all of us, one way or another. If I'm obliged to wait for more favourable prices, some of the slaves already purchased will die on my hands.
He had no hope now of getting any reduction in the prices. He knew obduracy when he met it, and he had met it now in this slack-wristed, invalidish fellow. But long experience had taught Thurso that an argument is rarely lost completely if it is persisted in, and certain concessions he was still hoping for.
"What is to stop us trading independently?" he said.
The governor smiled at this, not very pleasantly. "There is no independent trade here, my friend," he said. "Not as far as our writ runs, and it runs far. You have heard, no doubt, what happened to the Indian maid. Very sad business. They were attempting to trade privately upriver and were cut off by the natives and two killed and the longboat a total loss. We could do nothing to help them."
"I have heard what happened to the Dutchman with the Corrimante negroes aboard."
Thurso fixed his eyes on the other, but could detect no slightest change in the expression of his face. "The natives are very loyal here," the governor said, with a return to his more nonchalant manner. "They see the company as their father." If Thurso had doubts on this score, he gave no indication of it. After a long moment, he said,
"Well, it seems that I shall have to trade on your terms, sir, if I want to trade at all."
"I am glad you take that view, Captain. You will have your pick of the slaves, sir, I can promise you that." And it was on this note of harmonious accord between them that Thurso obtained the spoils of the vanquished, which he had all this while, in his dogged and cunning fashion, been pursuing. On the understanding he would take the slaves presently in the dungeons, subject to their being passed as fit, the governor agreed to let him have 8 armed men and 2 canoes for a week's absence on private business, the expenses of this to be charged to the company. Meanwhile, D'Herblon had not yet made clear to the surgeon the nature of the advice he was seeking, though both men had made some inroads into the brandy by this time, and had grown fairly confidential with each other. The painter occupied a single square-built chamber, which seemed to have been intended originally as a guard-room. It was high on the ramparts, at the same level as the governor's quarters, but facing east, away from the sea. The night was warm, and D'Herblon's windows were open. He had stretched squares of fine bobbin net across them to keep out insects.
"I carry these nets around with me wherever I go,"
the young man said. "I had rather do without a bed than without those." Moonlight shone through these precious screens, silvering the mesh as if to confirm D'Herblon's high estimate. Though earlier wreathed about in cloud, the moon had risen clear now and hung in the sky serene and radiant. Blanched pools lay below the casement windows, and D'Herblon's shadow fell momentarily across them as he walked to and fro, holding his glass. An array of paints and brushes and jars lay on a low trestle table against one wall. In the centre of the room, masked by a square of pale cloth, touched down one edge by moonlight, a canvas stood on an easel.
"This moonlight is amazing strong," Paris said. "Strong enough to read by against the windows. I can hear the sea still, but it does not lie before us, does it?"
"No, the room looks east along the coast. I'm on the leeward side here. It grows confounded hot during the day. The best quarters are those that get the sea breeze, like those of our esteemed governor."
As he spoke, D'Herblon glanced with a harassed expression at the veiled canvas.
"As you'd expect," he added,
running a hand through his thick, already somewhat disordered, light brown hair.
"That is he, isn't it? Under the sheet?"
Paris nodded at the easel.
"Yes, that is he," D'Herblon said. However, he made no move to uncover the painting. "Have some more brandy," he said.
"I will."
Waiting for his glass, Paris was struck suddenly by the wonder of existence. He said, "It is quiet, but for the waves, I could not tell for a while what the difference was, but it is that they have stopped their hammering.
What?
Ah, no, they will begin again. They need a store of coffins in reserve. You cannot keep corpses long in this climate. For most of the last week they have been at it. Practically all the time I have been...
He broke off, as if struck by some notion.
I wonder if that is the reason, he said.
What do you mean?
You will understand when you see the portrait, I think. But I shall need another glass before bringing it to view. Anyway, it is an ill wind that blows no one good. The Reverend Calabanda has been kept busy with funerals, for which he gets an emolument from the company.
Delblanc's expression of harassment gave way suddenly to a smile.
There's a character for you. That unctuous way he talked about preaching to his free brethren. His free brethren have to listen to his sermons whether they want to or not. They are all in debt to the company, which makes it a policy to give them drams and goods on credit. The company could sell them tomorrow to recover the debts, and they know it.
Like Tucker, Paris said.
Who is he?
Oh, he is a mulatto trader on the Sherborough River, where we've just been. He has a big trade connection there and is the principal man of the region. By advancing credit, he puts people in fear of him and so gets everyone in his power.
Well, it is common practice,
Delblanc said, and not only in Africa, though one sees it in a pure form here, not so much shrouded with hypocrisy.
One sees the sacredness of money.
He passed a hand through his hair again. His eyes were light hazel in colour, very large in the iris, and set rather shallow. With a clear, high forehead, they gave to the whole face a sincerity almost disturbing in its nakedness and absence of concealment, and greatly at odds with the gentlemanly off-handedness of his manner. He was smiling slightly now, but his expression was unhappy and rather bitter.
"Money is sacred, as everyone knows," he said. "So, then, must be the hunger for it, and the means we use to obtain it. Once a man is in debt, he becomes a flesh-and-blood form of money, a walking investment. You can do what you like with him. You can work him to death, or you can sell him. This cannot be called cruelty or greed, because we are seeking only to recover our investment, and that is a sacred duty. Still, the Negroes are not much worse off than the whites, from what Sanders tells me. He is one of the factors here.
Yes, we met this afternoon. He took us to see the slaves. He did not look in good health to me.
He will die if he does not get away from here. He would leave if he could, while he still has some chance of recovering his health, but he cannot. The company has got him as fast as if he were in chains. £75 a year sounds well enough in Leadenhall Street, but when he got out here, he found that it was paid in cracker.
What is that?
It is a kind of false currency that can only be used in the company stores, at company prices. It is all Saunders can do to buy kanki, palm oil, and a little fish to keep himself alive. For other necessaries, he has to go into debt, and the others are all in the same case. I tell you, they are all a company of white Negroes here, and it is the same in the other trading forts I have been in. The only ones who do well out of it are the high officials of the company.
He glanced again, involuntarily it seemed, at the veiled portrait on the easel.
If they live long enough, that is, death is good for my business as well as Calabanda's, or the threat of it at least. There is nothing like the shadow of mortality for inclining a man to have his portrait painted. But what the sitter pays for, Mr. Paris, is the promise of life.
Just take a look at this, sir.
Delblanc finished what was left in his glass and moved towards the easel. After a final moment of hesitation, he threw back the cover.
Good heavens,
Paris exclaimed. Whatever he had expected, it had not been this.
What have you done to him?
The likeness was remarkable. The artist had perfectly caught the high-bridged, disdainful nose, the languid eyelids, but the eyes were fixed, the bloodless mouth frozen in avarice, and the whole face stark with ultimate composure. It was a mask of death that looked at him.
"Now do you see what I mean?"
Delblanc spoke as if making a point in an argument.
A man who lives in perpetual fear of dissolution, who is forever dosing himself and taking his own pulse, and I have depicted him as a death's head. It only happened in these last 2 days. The portrait was finished, or so I thought.
He had done his sittings. I was intending only some finishing touches, heighten the fresh tones, ennoble the expression and so on, the usual embellishments, you know. Then, I don't know how it happened. A touch here, a touch there, the line of the mouth, the set of the eyes, and this face emerged under my brush, and I can't bring myself to change it. It is the truth of the man, and something more than that. But of course he won't like it.
No, conceded Paris. He won't like it. He felt a little light-headed after the wine at dinner and the brandy now, and the lapping light and shadow in the room, and this staring, moon-touched portrait of a stricken miser.
He won't like it at all, he said. And if he doesn't like it,
Delblanc pursued with a sort of gloomy logic, he won't take it, and if he doesn't take it, he won't pay. But it's not really that. I'm not short of money for the moment.
No, but you see, he could make things devilish unpleasant for me, if he wanted. And he would want, I feel sure.
Delblanc gestured at the portrait.
You only need look at his face to see that. I could find myself in the dungeons on some trumped-up charge. We are a long way from home, and justice is a relative concept at the best of times. 3 degrees of latitude reverses the whole of jurisprudence. It was Pascal said that, wasn't it? I don't feel like taking the risk. It is for that reason I thought of taking passage with you.
As to that, Paris said, I think it would be best if you deal direct with Thurso himself. My recommendation would not dispose him in your favour.
Quite the contrary.
Delblanc nodded.
He did not appear very fond of you. My purse, such as it is, will best recommend me to the captain. He will take me, I have no doubt of it. It is not only to save my skin I want to get away.
He paused to replenish the surgeon's glass and his own.
To be quite frank, he said, and it was difficult to imagine his ever being much else, I am fair sick of what I am doing and assisting in here. I have had to paint a good number of faces in order to get to this one. For 18 months now I have been painting likenesses of company officials and agents and resident merchants up and down from Jamesfort to Elmina, not only English, but Dutch and French too. Now I have come upon their collective face. It is no accident that it has sprung out under my brush. Since I came to this coast, I have seen things and heard of things, Paris, that I will take to the grave with me. The ships come and trade on the edges. You may think only the edges are fouled with this trade, but it is not so. The flood of cheap manufactures, for which the people have no need, destroys their industries. They become dependent on this trade, and the demand for goods can only be met by enslaving their fellows. To do this, they need muskets in ever-increasing quantities, which we supply. And so, we spread death everywhere. But that sacred hunger we spoke of justifies all. The trade is lawful, they say, and that is enough. Well, it is not enough for me. That face on the easel is the face of plunder and death, sir. It is the face of Europe in Africa. It is an unacceptable face to me, sir, and I cannot go on any longer painting it. I have come to the end of portraits, on this coast at least. A man can hold off the truth of things for purposes of making a living. That is legitimate, I suppose, though ignoble. But when the face is there before your eyes, it cannot simply be expunged, you see? As if it had never existed. Not when heart and mind have worked together to produce it.
Heart and mind, Paris repeated, struck by this simple and unaffected yoking of the two. Once again he was aware of some essential ingenuousness in the painter, a quality of innocence that had survived the wandering and makeshift life. He encountered the transfixed and horrendous stare of the face in the portrait. Moonlight lay along the pallid temples, revived a gleam of avarice in the dead left eye.
Yes, the painter said with the same eagerness, to make a good likeness you must have heart and mind working together, but the heart comes first.
The heart is a vital organ, Paris said in his serious and slightly pedantic way,
but it is a faulty guide to conduct. It is the mind makes judgments and comparisons, furnishes evidence on which ideas of truth can be founded. I take an opposite view,
D'Herblant said excitedly. No man will ever find virtue by the mind alone. To think so was the folly of the Greeks. This trade we are helping in our different ways, do you think it comes about through the dictates of the heart? Not truly of the mind either, but greed can take that colouring, as can other vices. Yes, sir. And so our natural instincts are perverted. Do you think for a moment that men would enslave one another if they lived in a state of nature?
Well, it is a large question, Paris said doubtfully, and one that cannot be easily answered.
You are right. Let us have some more brandy now, so that we can the better discuss it.
Whether it was D'Herblant's precipitation of speech, or his readiness to forget his troubles at the prospect of debate, Paris did not quite know, but there was something about this eagerness that moved him now with a mingled sense of comedy and pain. Quite suddenly, with that lonely urgency that comes at times to reticent natures, he wanted to entrust something to this man, so frank and unaffected, so unforced in his transitions from thought and sensation to speech.
"We can discuss it if you like," he said, "but there is something I wanted to say before, and didn't. You spoke about the need to make a living, and how it inclines us to evade the truth of things, but I have not even that excuse."
"But it is your livelihood, as I understand the matter. I suppose you do not offer your services free."
"I did not need to take my uncle's offer," Paris said. "My uncle is the owner of the ship I am serving on. I could have gone to another part of England, or to one of the colonies. I could have gone to America, where there is need of doctors."
"You needed to get away, then?"
The gentle matter-of-factness of this brought a tightness to Paris's throat that he had not anticipated. Those confiding their pain cannot know at the outset how much they will be required to relive it, but he knew that he was set on a course here, in this room from which the moonlight was receding, leaving it darker, before a man he hardly knew, and a face of death.
"Yes," he said harshly, "I needed to get away, but I did not need to take a post on a slave ship. I did not need to use my profession, of which I was proud once, to certify people as fit for branding and chaining."
"I suppose you thought it didn't much matter," D'Herblant said, in the same tone of gentle simplicity,
"what you did with yourself, I mean."
At this the surgeon rose in his turn and began pacing to and fro across the room.
"It never mattered what I did, as far as only myself was concerned," he said. "It doesn't matter now. I don't care what becomes of me, but I had no right. I should not have argued in favour of the mind just now. That was only for argument's sake. I still have that vice. It was my insistence on opinion, concealed under the appearance of a desire for truth, that ruined me and killed my wife. Yes, sir, killed her."
Paris nodded fiercely, as if he thought the other might attempt to contradict him.
"By my arrogant folly, I killed her and the child she was carrying."
He paused to drink what was left in his glass, though hardly aware of the action.
"We lived in Norfolk," he said, "where I practiced as a surgeon apothecary. I became interested in fossil remains and what they can tell us about the age of the earth, and also in the evidence of rises and falls of the earth's surface through long ages of time. I began to form a collection of marine fossils, some of them found high above the level of the sea. The existence of these cannot be reconciled with the account of creation given to us in the Bible. So far, if it had been a mere question of my private studies, all would have been well. There are men of science all over Europe quietly forming their opinions on such matters. But I, sir, I had to air my discoveries and opinions. I acquired a printing press and issued pamphlets in which I championed the views of Maupertuis. Perhaps you're acquainted with his work."
"Not even with his name, I'm afraid," D'Herblant said. "I have not taken much interest in such matters.
He is a man of genius."
Despite his distress, Paris's tone had quickened with admiration for this hero of his youth.
"His name has been obscured by misapprehension and envy, but one day his worth will be known. By his investigations into heredity, he has shown how, from two individuals only, the multiplication of the most dissimilar species could grow, owing their origin to some accidental formation, an error, you could say, each error creating a new species."
"But that would mean that we ourselves are the result of error also, that we need not have been as we are."
"Yes, some different accidents might have occurred, or so Maupertuis would say. Something impossible to imagine. I was greatly struck by these ideas when first I read them. They seemed to offer an explanation of the diversity of creatures, something which had always puzzled me. And they confirmed my own conclusions about the age of the Earth, because such changes would have needed great periods of time to accomplish.
Paris paused, swallowing at some impediment.
Great periods of time, he repeated in a voice that trembled slightly.
They were dear to his memory, these early studies and speculations, his desk in the lamplight, Ruth busy somewhere not far.
I published these theories, he went on after a moment. They run counter to orthodox opinion, and especially to the teachings of the Church. I was warned, not only by those who were hostile, but by friends and colleagues. Yes, I was well warned, but I paid no heed.
Paris stopped his pacing and stood still in the centre of the room, looking fixedly at Delblanc, who sat out of the candlelight, his face in shadow.
I was clad in the armour of truth, the surgeon said. Or so I thought, or so I pretended to think.
He tried to smile, but failed.
In fact, I was merely obstinate and overweening, vices which I have still. I was arrested on a complaint of the Bishop of Norwich. The judge was in the Church interest. He found me guilty of issuing a seditious publication, imposed a fine beyond my means, and consigned me to prison until it was paid. My uncle redeemed the debt when he learned of it, but while I lay in prison, a mob set on by the Church party broke into my house with a view to smashing the press, and in the course of this they terrified my wife so that she miscarried. She was not a strong woman, and she did not recover. I did not see her die.
These unguarded negatives broke the control which he had struggled to maintain by an appearance of reporting on facts.
She died without me,
he said, and his voice broke on it. He saw the artist make a sudden movement as if to rise and come towards him. He said quickly,
"You would serve me best by staying as you are. I do not know why, for the life of me, but I am set on speaking to you as I have spoke to no one else, and I need a distance between us if I am to get through to the end."
For some moments, however, he was obliged to remain silent, checking the tears that had threatened him at Delblanc's impulse to kindness. The hardest part still lay before him. Below the acknowledgement of blame, below the self-reproach, at the deepest level of confession, lay the words that would express the shame of what had been done to him. It was characteristic of Paris that he should seek a way to it through argument.
"You quoted Pascal just now," he said. 3 degrees of latitude reverses the whole of jurisprudence. Delblanc, no latitude makes any difference to what men will do to other men, whether for gain or in the name of justice. Publishing seditious material is a felony in our law. Before I began my prison sentence, they set me 12 hours in the pillory. In our enlightened land, for publishing the view that the earth is older than 6,000 years, and thus contradicting revelation, I was chained by the legs to a post. My head and hands were stuck through a board and clamped there, and I was left to the mercies of the crowd for a night on the market square of Norwich. Pilloried alongside with me, there was a man who had been convicted of sodomy. Fortunate for me, because he diverted the wrath of the mob, and so I was saved from injury at their hands. He was stoned by the whores of the town. In the morning, when they came for us, he was insensible. I do not know to this day whether he lived or died.
Paris's voice was unhesitating now. The droning fluency of nightmare had descended on him. As he spoke, he had the sense of a steady seepage of filth and blood, a stain that spread with his words in this quiet room, with no check to him in Delblanc's motionless figure, or the hideous silence of the governor, and only the distant booming of the sea for admonition.
The festering restraint of months fell away from him, and the agony of his humiliation returned, licensed, almost welcomed, that crouching, ludicrous, beast-like posture, the terrible exposure of the naked face and head, detached from the rest of the body, offered like a pumpkin at a fair for the crowd to shy at, the hanging head and meek hands of the sodomist, his face and hair all pulped and bloody, like a burst pumpkin, lolling there, still unable to retract his head from his tormentors, his pleading mercy made indistinct by the blood that had filled his mouth. He checked himself at last, and a deep gasp, like a sob, broke from him. Legitimate means of livelihood! The face of truth that cannot be denied! I wanted to look them in the face when they came to release me in the morning. I had prepared myself, but I could not stand upright. I was led away, crouching still, with back bent like some submissive animal. And yet, I came here. I knew what it is to be shackled and derided, and still I came. How can that be forgiven? Another groan came from him, humiliation almost worse than that grey morning's, the knowledge of his folly, to think that despair can exonerate, that the desire for death can remove the burden of conscience. And it is not even true, he said, turning half-blindly and moving to the window, as if for some refuge in the night outside. It was not true then, and it is not now. The moon was high and clear of cloud, astoundingly radiant, eclipsing the stars. Moonlight gleamed in a sheet of silver over the marshes and flats of mud they had crossed to come here, so cluttered and tawdry by day, all unified and resplendent now, as if lying under some momentary blessing. And for a moment this transforming moonlight was confused in Paris's mind with the sunlight of earlier, the form of the woman edged with fire against the bars. It is not even true that I want to die, he said. And with this ultimate confession, he saw the moonlit levels run together and glimmer, as if washed in some thin solution of silver, and then blur to bright webs, as the tears, held long in check, came freely now to his eyes. Chapter 33. On the day following his return aboard, Paris resumed his journal, which he had neglected of late, with so many calls on his time and attention. He felt in any case disinclined for any more active occupation this afternoon. His limbs were heavy, and he was experiencing a slight but persistent sense of oppression above the eyes. He would have liked to sleep, but to do so with a sense of a task unfulfilled went against the grain of his nature. Self-denying generations spoke in his blood against it. Hunched at his small table, aware intermittently of the foul smell from the ship's bilges, he wrote on doggedly. Delblanc was right when he said his purse would sufficiently recommend him. He came aboard this morning, with a small cabin trunk and a rather dressed-up, festive look. I suspect he is a man who likes changes and adventures, and perhaps especially those not much premeditated. Apparently he did not wait to see the effect of his portrait upon the governor. There is something reckless in Delblanc. I feel him to be a generous-hearted man who might go astray in practice, though he would not behave ignobly. But he seems accountable to no one, and free to follow the promptings of his nature. In this he is different from myself, and perhaps it is why I feel drawn so towards him, the more now in gratitude for his friendship and patience last evening. I am glad he is to be with us. We have had already some resumption of our discussion on the merits of heart and head. His arguments in defence of untrammelled liberty and the natural goodness of his heart are delivered with no less enthusiasm as he paces the deck of a slave ship. There is something touching in this fervour, something absurd, too. Like all good theorists, he is not much troubled by incongruities of circumstance. Might it be true that men would live together in peace and harmony if only the coercion of authority were lifted from them? When I look into the faces of my fellows, I find it hard to credit. With Delblanc, there have come aboard two new crew members, recruited at the fort, Lise and Rimmer.
The former seems a decent man enough, a cooper by trade, badly scarred with smallpox. He is a former seaman, though I understand he has been 2 years employed by the company here. The other man, Rimmer, has one of the most debauched and vicious faces I have seen, swollen with drink and rough living, and with an ugly expression of the eyes, like a dog that would bite if it dared. He either ran from, or was abandoned by, another slaver that came earlier, and has since been living, as he can, here on the coast. Shortly after coming aboard, he must have behaved with some insolence, or perhaps merely indifference, towards Barton, who struck him a blow with his open hand, which could be heard all over the ship. I saw this incident myself. It was only a slapping blow, but Rimmer was knocked sideways. He knew better than to attempt a retaliation, but there was murder on his face. I did not see much change on Barton's.
"You do what I tell you," I heard him say, "and you do it prompt, or you'll never reach Jamaica."
Of course, Barton knows that he must take such a man in hand from the outset. He is in command for these days. Thurzo has gone ashore on some business of his own. That look of the eyes is not so common among us. I saw it sometimes in prison. It belongs to men who will always be ready to do more hurt than they need. Tapley has something of it, but he is less bold than this new man. He needs the shelter and bidding of another, and his prefect, Libby, has not this wickedness in his face, but seems merely brutal and unfeeling. It seems that I am become an expert on faces. Men like Hughes and Kavanagh have a savage eye, so intent in regard as to seem almost innocent, with that sort of fierce innocence which has known no chastening or softening. I saw that expression again on the faces of the Gold Coast negroes who stared at us through their bars. I do not know if the woman belonged with that group. Thurzo had already looked them over and purchased them before I was stirring next morning, having apparently agreed on a price with the governor the night before. She is tall, like them, but lighter-skinned, tawny rather than black, and her hair not so wiry. I am cursed with too much doubt or compunction. I do not know what to call it. Perhaps it was only a figment of that mood of hope that came to me as I walked behind Saunders through those passages, but it was as if she waited there, in the sunlight. Kavanagh came aboard this morning with a monkey on a rope, a bright-eyed little creature with tufted ears and a tail longer than itself, and very prettily coloured, a black crown on him and a small white face, and arms and feet pale orange colour. Kavanagh is very taken with it, though he does not like to appear so, at least not to me, I think out of some sort of shyness. Blair speaks to me freely since we treated Callie's back together, and he told me they had gone ashore soon after sunrise with Haines to get firewood and shoot pigeons, of which there are large flocks at present in the trees just a little back from the shore. While there, they had met a party from the American grain ship in the road with us, who were on the same business. One of these had the monkey, and seeing Kavanagh much taken with it, had offered to sell it to him. Kavanagh had no money, but he had a silver chain round his neck, his only possession. On the kind of impulse which seems common with these men when they want something that is before their eyes, he pulled this off and offered it in exchange. To my less impulsive nature, this seemed extravagant, but I could tell that Blair would have done the same thing. The creature sat quite comfortably on Kavanagh's shoulder, turning its muzzle to look at our faces and raising the skin on its scalp in a very comical way, as if it were constantly being surprised by the tenor of our conversation. Thurzo will not be back for some days yet. There is some mystery about his absence, as there is about our lingering here at all. Why trade for negroes through the fort if prices are higher? Thurzo is not a man to pay more than he needs, and it cannot be that he wishes to keep good relations for the future, as Barton once let fall to me that this is the captain's last voyage. I believe he has come down to this stretch of coast with some private purpose, and that Barton is privy to it. Paris laid down his pen. He was feeling distinctly unwell. The heaviness in his limbs had intensified, and his temples throbbed painfully with any slightest movement of his eyes. He made himself a strong infusion of powdered cinchona bark and took to his bed, where within an hour he was experiencing the first assaults of a violent fever. There followed a period for Paris undistinguished by passage of hours, marked only by alterations of sweating and shivering. In the lulls he continued to dose himself with infusions of cinchona and battled to repair his copious sweats with lemon water. Sullivan, who had taken over from Charlie the duty of seeing to the surgeon's wants,
Thurzo would not have given permission to a fore-the-mast man to do it, came that evening at the change of watch, found his charge muttering and tossing and conversing with shadows, and ran to get rainwater from the butt, so as to make cold compresses for the surgeon's face and chest. This had been done to Sullivan by a woman somewhere in his scattered past, and it had been a memory of love to him. It was all he knew of treating fevers, but he was assiduous in it, and was a devoted attendant to Paris all through his illness, sponging his brow, running to the galley with dried yarrow leaves from Paris's stock, so that Morgan could make him tea. On the morning of the fourth day, Paris woke, feeling weak but clear-headed. His restored senses brought sounds more typical of delirium, a hullabaloo above him of stamping feet, jangling chains, the jaunty persistence of the fiddle. The slaves were at their morning dance. He ate the breakfast provided by Sullivan, ship's biscuit, in which the occasional weevil was still to be found, and some rock-hard cheddar. He enjoyed both items hugely. He felt sure now that he had been suffering from the same type of fever which had earlier attacked Johnson and True, a kind of swamp fever, he believed, transmitted by the miasmic airs of the coast. If it were the same, he could expect further bouts. Johnson had suffered some return of it already, though True so far not. He dressed slowly and made his way up on deck, where the slaves were still exercising, Libby and Tapley moving among them with whips and curses, while McGann and Evans stood to the cannon on the deck above. The whole mid-part of the ship, forward of the mainmast, moved with this noisy, disorderly seething of the black bodies. They had been hosed down that morning, and the decks washed, and the contents of the ordinary buckets discharged over the sides, but there still came to Paris, as he stood on the side gangway, the sickening, fetid smell he had grown to recognise. The timbers were becoming ingrained with it. No scrubbing could remove it entirely. They would carry it back with them to Liverpool. The women and girls moved like sleepwalkers about the deck, sometimes raising their arms and swaying their bodies as if listening to some music more remote than that transmitted by Sullivan's quick elbow. The men jumped and lumbered in their shackles. Cries and groans and wavering phrases of song came from both men and women, mingling with the cracking of the whips and the heavy stamping of feet and rattling of chains, so that the notes of the fiddle were only intermittently audible. To Paris, with that deceiving clarity that comes after fever, a clarity in which there is still a sort of languid disorder, there came the fancy that Sullivan was sawing at the negro's chains. At this moment, with the same sense of heightened but unreliable perception, he saw that some of the younger boys, though moving to the music in apparent dance, were playing a game of ambush and kidnap in among the moving bodies of the adults. They were taking captives, he realised suddenly. With a lurch of feeling, he recognised among the dancers the woman who had looked at him in the dungeon of the fort. Her face was lowered now, expressionless. She must have been brought aboard while he lay ill. He looked among the men, but could not for the moment make out the Corrimante negroes. The woman had been given the same cotton waistcloth as the others, covering the pudenda, but leaving the sides of the thighs bare. The muscles of her haunches flexed smoothly as she turned in the motions of the dance. He removed his eyes from her to see Kavanagh come up from the forecastle with a monkey crouched on his shoulder and disappear in the direction of the latrines at the heads. At the same time, Thurzo emerged on the starboard side of the quarterdeck, with a scowling look of bad temper, Barton immediately behind him.
"Glad to see you recovered,"
the captain said, though nothing in his face showed pleasure.
"What the devil was that?"
he said to Barton.
"A monkey, sir."
"Tell the fiddler to stow his noise, will you? They've had enough of his infernal scraping, and so have I."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Barton bawled across the intervening space of deck. Libby, who had been waiting for it, nudged the heedless fiddler. The music stopped, and the dancing with it. The slaves were herded into their allotted space amidships by the men guarding them, who were eager now to finish and get below. It was close on 8 bells.
"They won't have that confounded animal running loose on my ship," Thurzo said. "Tell Kavanagh that."
"It sticks pretty close to him, from what I've seen," Paris said, taking some steps towards the captain.
"You must have returned while I was ill, sir," he said.
He encountered the small, beleaguered eyes, saw in them the usual fury at being questioned. It was clear that Thurzo was in the grip of some feeling stronger than the irritation caused by the sight of the monkey.
"I return to find that we have got a case of the bloody flux aboard," he said. "I return to find that, sir."
I did not know of it. Paris had sensed some accusation in the captain's words.
"I have been confined to my cabin these last few days. He is only 12 or so," Thurzo said, "so it is not so bad as it might be, but it is still a loss of 40 bars. That is not the worst of it, however. We will be obliged now to leave the coast early. I could have taken a dozen more that now I cannot wait for. We must get out to sea and trust we can be blown clean of it."
"He is dead, then?"
"Dead? He is shedding blood. He may die or he may recover. It makes no difference. He must be got off the ship."
"Got off the ship? You mean simply set down ashore?" Thurzo's monstrous simplicity, as always, had taken him completely by surprise. "But he could be treated," he said hastily. For a moment, absurdly, he was under the impression that Thurzo had overlooked this possibility.
"I can make up a panegyric," he went on eagerly. "A tincture of opium has often been found efficacious in cases of severe diarrhea, with a preparation of fennel that I know of. Fennel is an excellent—" "Good God!"
Thurzo broke in with a sudden violence of fury that made Paris flinch.
"Must I waste my breath arguing with a damned landsman who knows nothing but country remedies? I am talking about bloody flux. If it gets a hold on us here, we can lose half our cargo. Do you know what that means in money? Am I to wait on the chance that you will cure him with your damned bruise? And if you fail, no, sir, not another word."
Thurzo paused, visibly struggling with his passion. All his detestation of the surgeon came out in this moment. He advanced, his face darkly congested with rage, and said in his hoarse monotone,
"I command on this ship. I will have you muzzled like a dog and sent to kennel below if you argue another syllable with me."
Paris was silent, looking down before him at the deck. Brought to this pass, Thurzo would do as he threatened. Owing, perhaps, to the weakness consequent upon his fever, he could feel no saving fury now, as he had on previous occasions, only an immense weariness and discouragement. It was not the other's brutality that was too strong for him, but his logic. There was no answering it. It was why they were all there.
"I do not argue further," he said.
"May I have your permission to go ashore with the boy and take the linguista?"
"You need no linguista with you to leave the boy on the beach,"
Thurzo said. However, after a moment's pause, he gave his consent in an indifferent mutter. The punt was lowered, the shivering boy fetched up, and soon Paris found himself making for shore with Jimmy beside him in the stern and 4 men to row them. He had no plan of action. He did not believe there was any action to take. His request had been involuntary, almost, an impulse to hurt himself, to share in what was being done to the boy. But it occurred to him now that they might find some help ashore for him, or some shelter at least.
"Ask him where he comes from," he said to the linguista. "Perhaps he comes from this part of the coast."
"You not belong here," Jimmy said.
"This boy Vi people, I think so."
He spoke a few words to the boy, who turned deep-set eyes on him, straining and imperfectly focused, as if he were staring through a screen of mist or flame. After a moment he replied in a soft mumble, raising a thin hand in a vague, pointing motion.
"You say he comes from over there,"
Jimmy repeated the vague gesture. He smiled with pity and scorn.
"This boy don't know where he is," he said, "so he can't say where he come from. He points anywhere comes into mind. Point up at sky, all same thing."
"I don't believe you understand a word of what he's saying,"
Paris said. "You're only pretending."
"Pretending? Part of linguista's job," Jimmy said with dignity. "This boy speak one Vi language. Nobody understand what this boy says, except maybe few hundred people round the Galinas River. That's 10-12 days sail from here, sir."
The boy looked at their faces with his wide, strained stare, in which, however, there was something of appeal. He knew he was being discussed. He was quite naked. His teeth were chattering faintly, and Paris could see the rise and fall of his thin chest. With an austere avoidance of Jimmy's gaze, he took off his shirt and placed it round the boy's shoulders. Their departure had been witnessed by several people, and it formed a subject of discussion among a group, clustered together forward, below the jib boom.
"Thurzo never does out without a reason," Wilson said. "And there's no but one reason why he would put a slave ashore and lose the price. The boy's got something wrong with him."
"The flux or the smallpox, them is the two worst," Kavanagh said.
The monkey sat on his shoulder, turning its black muzzle to watch their faces and repeatedly raising the loose skin on its scalp. Kavanagh was making a cage for it, constructed out of bamboo canes which he had cut ashore.
"Why is that animal always making faces?"
Libby demanded, his solitary eye fixing the monkey with a look of dark disapproval.
"Monkeys spread the pox. I wouldn't be surprised if it isn't him that is spreading it now."
Kavanagh split one of the canes down the middle with his knife. He was clever at making things. All the movements of his hands were neat and clean.
"He don't do it so much when he is just with me," he said. "Being in a crowd unsettles him."
Blair winked at Sullivan.
"What it is," he said, "he does it when he gets to windward of bloody great farts like those you've just been letting go off, Libby. If I had a loose scalp, I would do the same."
"He is clever," Kavanagh said with pride. "He knows what's going on. He knows me already. He won't go to no one else."
The monkey, aware of being the centre of attention, retracted its head and tucked in its chin shyly. After a moment, with a languid and fastidious gesture of one reddish arm, strangely human and hairless on the inside, it reached out, fumbled gently on Kavanagh's matted hair, found something there, peered at it closely with wise, amber-coloured eyes, and then swallowed it.
"Ha-ha!" Cally said. "He found something! He found a nit!"
His eyes were round.
"You are full of nits, Kavanagh," he said with delight. "What is his name?"
"I'm calling him Vasco," Kavanagh said. There was a certain quality of defensiveness in his tone. "That's a sea-going name I've heard tell of. He's a regular sailor. The fellow that sold him told me you'll eat salt beef and biscuit." He had begun binding the cross-pieces with strands of yarn, and he lowered his head over the task to conceal his pride in the versatile and omnivorous Vasco.
"A monkey can be the saving of a ship,"
Sullivan said, glancing round with his usual haunted expression.
"They have the gift of second sight. I knew of a monkey once. He was kept on a bit of rope like this one. The ship was standing off the Bahama bank. She was a two-masted ship with a square rig like this one. Same type of monkey, same type of ship. That's a funny thing now, but she wasn't carrying slaves."
"I wish you'd keep to the bloody point," Blair said irritably. "What the jig does it matter what type of ship she was?"
"Dim channels are dangerous for any vessel," Sullivan said, "let alone a square-rigged merchantman that can't keep close to the wind. Anyway, they are sailing into the wind when the monkey slips his rope and makes a dart for the rigging. He climbs up to the crow's nest before anyone can stop him, looks out to sea, then starts gibbering and pointing. No one can see anything. There is nothing to see. The monkey is going frantic and frothing at the jaws. He runs down and gets the captain's telescope from his cabin and brings it to him, but the captain can't see anything wrong. Then the monkey starts swinging from side to side, hanging to the rat lines by his tail, pointing down at the water."
Carried away by his narrative, Sullivan twisted his head to a grotesque angle and made stabbing gestures with a long forefinger down at the deck.
"What the devil's upset in the crater?" everybody's asking. "Nobody knows. The captain doesn't believe there is anything amiss, but he decides to take a soundin'. He can hardly believe his eyes. They are in 7 fathom water and moving into the bank. 5 minutes more and they would have been grounded there with a rising sea. They put about just in time, and it was all due to dat monkey."
"What was the point of fetching the telescope?"
Wilson said, after an appreciable pause.
"They were nowt to see."
I grant you it made a mistake there," Sullivan said. "There was limits to its sagacity. I'm not the man to deny that." "How did the monkey know?"
Cally said.
"Ah, there is the question," Sullivan said. "There is things in nature very difficult to explain."
There was a short silence. No one but Cally had completely believed this story.
"Well," McGann said, "coming back to this blockie they've shipped ashore, I'll lay even Saxpence it is a case of bloody flux. He didn't look to have much fever. Libby, you can find out for Haines. I'll take the bet."
"Will you listen to that now?" Sullivan said. "You still owe me that shilling for standing up to Turzo. Billy, use me witness."
"He cannot witness to what he never heard. How do we know what you said to Thurzo? You might have gone in there and said any trumped-up thing."
"I told you the truth of it," Sullivan said. "Are you making to call me a liar, McGann?"
McGann looked at him with pity. He shook his head.
"Truth or lies, doesn't come into it," he said. "This is a question of money."
Paris returned bare-chested and barefoot, having left his shirt with the sick boy and his shoes, for the sake of their silver buckles, with an old woman in a thatched hut on the shore above the beach, whom he thought must have mothered children in her time. Squatting on thin hams at the entrance, smoking a clay pipe, she had listened impassively while Jimmy said what Paris had told him to say. This child was sick in the stomach by Sauvamonu. He was under the special protection of the great fort. The governor himself took a particular interest in this child, as he did in all the weak and helpless. The governor and his redcoats would be watching from afar to make sure that this child was well treated. The governor had a mighty telescope up in the sky, right at the top of the fort, and through his telescope he could see everything that happened. The woman chewed briefly on bare gums, then replied at some length in a high-pitched, querulous voice.
"What does she say? Does she undertake to care for the child?"
"She says she don't believe the government have any interest in dis boy. He too busy selling healthy boy to bother about one small boy with Sauvamonu belly. She say to redcoats, 'Kiss my ass, pardon me, sir.' She talk big mouth."
Jimmy said in a scornful aside,
"Nobody take old hag for sleep."